All right, welcome back to the Language of Behavior. We had kind of a hiatus with guests, but you all had a wonderful opportunity to not only see and hear myself and Charlie Peck, but also with Dr. Stephen Bean, who had a really impactful story. And we're coming with you with another fantastic guest. And I said last time that we're very picky about who we choose to bring on to this podcast. So to have Victoria Veneziano.
Great.
All right. I knew it was going to be a tongue twister, and I always jack up. Charlie can attest this. Names. My poor students over the years. So, Charlie, first off, I want to say it's great to see you.
You too.
Once again this week.
Yes,
and then, of course, our special guest, Victoria, thank you so much for being here with us.
My pleasure. And my poor students, with Veneziano is my last name. We cut it down quite often.
Miss B. Miss B is probably was.
I call it about 19 times a day on average. It's Italian aesthetic, but not quite in the American mouth yet.
I even practiced and I still fumbled the bag. So I will do better next time, I promise. But yeah, I don't know how Stamper was hard for students to pronunciate, but I got a lot of Stanford. I don't know how that was even in the realm of possibilities, but I got that quite often.
Yeah, our brains make up things often. So that can be simple there. I hope no one
very
knows
easy.
That.
Very yeah. easy.
All right, Victoria, let's dive in because it was so much fun to get to know you. We have a mutual friend, Mitch Weathers, who's been on this podcast with us before, and he's such a wonderful guy. And every time he connects me with someone, I automatically know they're an amazing person and it's someone that I want to make sure that, you know, I have conversation with. And yeah, we just hit it off and I'm so excited to learn more about your educational background. So can we start there and you can just share like how it shaped the way you think about teaching and learning and all the wonderful things that you did in the world of education?
Thank you. I will. I mean, 20 years of educator experience really ping-ponged me quite a bit through the realm of education. I packed up my bags when I was 3 and sat my cousins, friends, anyone I could get to pay attention to play teacher. So I have been teacher since I was about speaking age, but started my career in Charleston, South Carolina, where I got my teaching credentials and actually was one of 5, count them on one hand, middle school majors because nobody wanted to take on my favorite age group. Spent 10 years in the classroom where I got to travel the world. I got to teach internationally. I was in Title I schools initially in my career, some elite embassy schools. So I've really seen the whole gamut. And when it came down to it, what I kept seeing is no matter the age, no matter the nation, no matter what they've been going through or where they were socioeconomically, they needed more support emotionally. And what our schools are asking teachers to do and wear these hats as counselors and mental health professionals, we're just not equipped for it. So I pivoted into training and learning a little bit more about teen mental health. I've spent 6 years working in the industry and connecting families to different treatment centers and different treatment options. And that really filled my soul in that capacity. But I was moving further and further away from the classroom, having moved into administration and then doing this mental health work. And what I was finding is that I really wanted to get back into equipping teachers with the things that I had learned. When I was in the classroom, I did my undergraduate studies on movement, specifically for middle schoolers, and how important it is to get up and moving every 5 to 10 minutes. What that does for not only engagement, but performance. Not anything new, but it is still very, very relevant. And that is part of the great work I get to do at Meteor Education, which my title is a learning experience coordinator. Pretty cool. Kind of what it sounds like if you break it down. I get to coordinate experiences around learning, all in the context of designing the interiors of classrooms. Specifically, Meteor is a furniture dealer. So we get to play with districts and architects and designers and say what environments we are creating are either going to help or hinder the learning experiences that you want your students to be having.
I'm going to jump in because my brain is swirling with questions. So we have so much in common. And Victoria, I'm excited about this because Josh and I wrote our whole chapter on the first tenet is about the environment. And we talk about environment as a social environment and the physical environment. So you truly are coming into this with such a great lens. And I'm wondering this. Here's what I'm wondering. What kind of pushback do you get from teachers when you talk with them about something they often think that they know a lot about, which they do, but how do you condition them to see a different perspective with the work that you do?
Great question, because I am a teacher. That's where I start with my heart. So I relate as a teacher first. So I get it. And I say, look, this classroom is your home. You probably spend more time here than you do in your own home sometimes for periods of time. And if someone was to come into my home and redecorate without me asking, I'd be pretty flared up and agitated. So starting from there, the pushback that we get, I drop down and I say, look, I understand. So what first thing I do is make sure that I do everything I can to convince the district, the architects, whomever, the construction managers, whoever's running the project, to get the teachers involved before we make choices so that they're part of the design discovery process. That's what we call it at Meteor, which essentially is saying to them, what are you doing in your classroom? How can we use the furniture to make that easier and better for you? So when you start there, the pushback deteriorates because they're seeing it what it is. It's an opportunity for them to change the things that are limiting them in their classroom. Is it always that beautiful picture? No. I would say 70% of the time they are getting what's mandated by the district. And so it is. It's training, it's finesse. It's saying, help me help you. What do you already love doing? And let's stick with what you love doing and see how these tools can become supportive of the things you love doing. And their resistance varies, right? Some people are super excited, Charlie, to have tools to allow them to fold tables down and push them out of the way and get their kids up and moving, or have their kids reassemble into clusters and then move into rows for whatever the different activities are. Some want them standard and not fidgety, and we work with them on that. But it is a large, widespread gamut of comfort and risk takers, just like any other change management that you're breaking into a new place to be.
So, Victoria, I want to go further on that because obviously, yeah, you got to start with the mind shift, right? That's why we ask them to consider, right? Let's be open-minded, taking in some different options and suggestions. But I want to ask about some specific examples. So like with the physical space, it could be a common area, hallways, classrooms. What was something that was intentionally designed that clearly changed not only the learning, but hopefully student behavior also?
Overarching, Meteor uses a foundation. It's actually our entire design philosophy called pro-social. And Charlie, this speaks a little bit to what you were saying about not only the physical, but the social. And we look at it as a whole ecosystem. So Josh, to your point about, you know, what's the piece that changes, I would say something as simple as one of our four components of pro-social is pods. So how are you setting up the kiddos so that they're knee to knee and eye to eye? Because that one takes the power dynamic out of it if we're at the same level. And two, when you're face to face with someone, or for some of our neurodivergent, slightly not direct eye contact, but you know, in that circular shape, when you're in a pod of 2 to 4, because we found the magic, somebody gets left out after 4. This is just one of the components that really changes behavior because it is the environment provoking the socialization. So I would say that is a really simple place to start. Even if you're not refurnishing your classrooms, rearranging into pods and groups, pairs or triples or fours, immediately is going to impact behavior and belonging.
Okay, so my question there is, what specifically makes that change? Like what are those dynamics that you're seeing that does make that significant change to where teachers are going to come back to you and say, oh my goodness, this is working. How will you explain that?
Well, let's start with what we're doing right now. Even though we're virtually connected, we can all see each other's faces. So we can react to what's happening based on what we've learned and been cued. Now, if we had a visualization of the back of someone's head, that's not inviting conversation, right? So we are cued then to not speak to them. I'm not going to talk to the back of someone's head. In fact, it's a little bit infuriating when you are talking to someone and they turn their back to you, right? We know those cues socially. We learn those cues in the classrooms that we're in. So I want to emphasize to your point, Charlie, a lot of teachers say, well, my kids couldn't handle that. They would just be talking the whole time. So we have to pair that with appropriate setting of norms, setting of team dynamics, creating language and conversation around the role that you have. Okay, what's my role in this seat? What are the cues and the things that we agree upon? So it's those same social contracts that they're already doing in their classrooms with the added emphasis of the physical arrangement to then promote those things that we've agreed upon.
All right. There's one specific thing that Charlie and I hear often. And right now in February and March timeframe, we get a lot with dysregulation. So is there something that our teachers or schools can do? And maybe it's a real simple change. I don't know. But I'd love to pick your brain as far as like, is there something for an existing building, something, you know, I was just on a campus that was constructed in 1930, you know, like the classrooms were small and like, it, you know, it's not the same as a new building now. So is there something that they can think about in regards specifically to student regulation?
That's a great question. We just did a whole very cool event called The Four Areas of Regulation, A Colorful Journey Through Our Emotions in San Diego. But it made me think of that, you know, Joshua, Charlie, you all probably walk hundreds of schools the same way I do every year. And I want to start by saying teachers are doing everything they can with what they have already. I see them bringing in pillows, ordering things off of Amazon, creating comfort and cozy spaces. Yes. And we can do better because one, we learned a lot from COVID about germs, and these are not the type of quality things that actually should be in the classroom, knowing that they hold germs, they hold a lot of things that, you know, aren't clean. So I just want to put out there that we know that the bringing into the classroom feels cozy. But when we're talking about regulation, going back to exactly what we're talking about today, the language of behavior, we have to do two things for kids. We have to give them the language and the self-awareness to be able to identify that they're not regulated. And then we need to give them agency. So the tools in the classroom for the agency can be simple. Do I know that when I'm feeling fidgety, when I'm feeling fizzy, we call it, we compare it to the different states of water in our experiential activity that we do. But when I'm feeling bubbly and fizzy, do I know that I, one, have permission to get up and take a rocky board underneath my feet? Do I know that I have permission to do a lap around the room? So one, giving permission, but two, then teaching and practicing the choices of the tools in the room. When I'm feeling frustrated, angry, and there is a soft donut piece in the room or a soft ottoman, am I allowed to squeeze it because I'm mad? Do I know that? And do I know that that choice exists? So ultimately, it's setting up those two things with whatever pieces you have in the classroom, permission, and then also awareness of, okay, well, I know I'm feeling this way. I know I'm allowed to do something about it. What are a few things that I know I can do?
Yeah, that permission is so important. I think a lot of teachers and leaders need permission to do certain things too, especially teachers. Like, can I give permission for the student to get up and move around? Can I give the student permission to ask and change what we've always learned about the whole traditional classroom? I mean, it's so different and it needs to adapt. But you said something so important here, Victoria, is the language. So I love to know, like, we all know language is really powerful. What kind of sentences or phrases do you give teachers to kind of encourage them to promote that pro-social behavior and that collaboration? Because that's important too.
That's a great question. And after a while, when you're so embedded in a culture and a language, you forget that other people aren't using it. So when they hear it and reflect it back to you, I really like that. That's where I tend to see that things are landing. What we do at Meteor is everything in your classroom is a tool. So we don't call it furniture. We call it a tool. This desk isn't a piece of furniture. It's a tool. This seat is a tool. The same way I might choose to use a pencil to do math so I can erase over a pen, we're giving, again, using the language of what tool do you need to complete this better? What learning spot would you like to choose to do your best learning? So that's one thing, is using the word as tool and setting up expectations around behaviors of how we're using the tools and the procedures for the tools, the same way teachers already do for so many things every day, right? How we go to the bathroom, how we treat each other. And then specifically, Charlie, to your question about pro-social, using words that we think, or modeling behaviors too, that we think are the teachings of kindergarten, I always say, kind, cooperation, caring, generosity. These things that we think, oh yeah, we went over that in kindergarten. They know that every single one of us in our adulthood could probably think of a few, I won't ask you to share out, but could think of a few people who would benefit from hearing and practicing those words every day. So inclusive words that are simple and well-known, but not said enough, is the language of pro-social.
All right. I want to know your hope for the future. Obviously, you have a passion for this work, but if you're looking ahead, what is your hope for how schools are building their environments and how these pro-social practices actually transform not only student learning, but also the behaviors that we see in schools?
My hope for the future actually, and anyone out there listening, you call me up, is really starting with the teachers, as taking care of the teachers first, because they can't show up and take care of the kids. So we are all, rightfully so, focused on the students. That is what the center of this is. But the burnout, the language, the things that our teachers don't get and are expected to give every day, I would like to give them. I would like to start at that level. My hope for the future is that teachers feel well taken care of, that teachers feel that they have agency, that teachers feel that they're creative and allowed and respected in a way from our larger society, our entire nation, you know, worldwide, that they feel that their profession is recognized as a profession, number one, and respected. And I think that's my hope for the future, is that we can find more training, more opportunities to relieve them from stress. And I also am a yoga teacher and a mindfulness practitioner. So any opportunity I have to offer free yoga for teachers, I'm always looking to, you know, offer that out, because we have to take care of the caretakers first. And I don't think it's fair to expect them to be able to all of a sudden change 20 years of teaching, 20 years of training, classroom management. I think it would be fantastic if we had a class, at least, and I have looked this up. So again, if either of you know where these are, a class around how the classroom environment, the physical built space, is a component of your teaching. If there was a class in teacher training programs at our universities and colleges, the way that we have classes around psychology or classroom management, that specifically around the furniture as tools, that would be mind-blowing for me to see.
I think we need to get on that, Victoria, because that's a need.
Do it. Call up the professor. Tell them we're ready.
We're trying. Actually, our book is being used at several universities, so we're excited about that.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yes, you should
be. Great points. Yeah, it should be. You're right. And I think we just needed to break free from the traditional education system, and more people are seeing it, and more people are talking about that neurodivergence and the movement. And so this just gives us space to do that and have those conversations and that permission.
Definitely. All right.
Should we do a behind the banter?
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it.
Victoria, this is a bit that we do each week, and we try to learn more about those who are behind the microphone. So I've got a really in-depth question for you today. So when you think of home, what is the first smell, sound, or image that comes to mind?
San Francisco. My heart is San Francisco. So the first smell would be sourdough bread. That is the smell. There's a lot of smells in this city.
Yeah, I've been there several times. I remember, yeah.
Down on Fisherman's Wharf, when you're walking by Bodine Bakery, and there's just in the air amongst the wrapping fog, Carl is what we call him. His name is Carl the Fog, and he's a big blanket of love. Images would be rolling hills and the Golden Gate Bridge. I have a very beautiful peak that I walk up to every morning with my dog. So you asked me for smells, images, and sounds. Seagulls, cars. Yep. The cars are very quiet because we have a lot of robot cars in this city now. And the trolley. Yeah, that's home for me. Hmm. Yeah.
I love that.
Charlie?
Cool question. All right.
I love that question. I know that's a lot. I think of bangles come to my mind. I mean, I see myself with my kids on the couch and the voices of my children. But I also hear the roar of the crowd for the Bengals and see us walking down there and kind of taking all that in together in this city. So I love that. But there is, like, the image that first came to mind for me was me sitting on the couch watching, like, cuddling up and watching a movie or a show with my whole family. That's what comes to mind for me. All right, Josh, what about you?
First thing that came to mind was Ventura Beach. I know I've lived in a lot of different areas, but the sound of the waves crashing, and I can picture the sand and the playground that we used to be on, the palm trees, the smell of the salt water coming in. So that's always like my calm place. Since we're talking about mental health, right? When you envision, you know, that space that you feel comfort in, that's always where I go to.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
All right. So hopefully everyone else listening can answer that own question and think about that and find your happy place. So with that, Charlie, do you want to have some closing comments for this episode as we wrap things up?
I do. I want to put it right back to Victoria because I just value your opinion and your perspective so much. So I'm going to ask you this. If a teacher's listening right now, or a leader who is trying to support a teacher right now who is so overwhelmed, because they are, what is one concrete step that they could take this week to make their classroom like both pro-social and supportive of their own well-being? So what is one concrete step they can take this week to create that environment that you talked about?
So this is going to upset some people because it's pretty difficult to do this, but the easiest, most simple thing to do is to distill the cognitive overload by taking things off the wall. So I cannot tell you how many classrooms I walk in with the best of intentions, but every inch of the wall is covered. And for neurotypical to neurodivergent, all of us are overstimulated in so many places every day. So the most simple thing you could do is take things off the wall and look around to see, am I using muted neutral colors? Am I using shapes and softness that mimics nature? So anything that you would think more spa and zen-like is actually the best place for our brains to be primed to learn because we're calm. So it's a really tricky one because they have the most beautiful bulletin boards and student work displays, but that would be my piece of advice.
Awesome. Yeah. I knew you'd say that. Like, I knew you'd come up with that because there's so much evidence backing that up. So anyone listening, like, take Victoria's advice on that. It really does make sense.
Yeah. I was the worst at that. As a former art teacher, my room was a lot. And every time parents would come in, their first reaction was, whoa, it was obvious that I had too much going on in that room. So hopefully my students aren't too scarred from that experience, but Victoria, we are honored to have you here. I'd love for you just to share out some ways that folks can connect with you. Obviously, we were flashing up the website as we were talking, but for our audio audience, those who are on podcast platforms, will you just share out how they can learn more about the work that you're doing and then also connect with you on social media?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. MeteorEducation.com is the organization I work for. I do have my own company called Mindful Movement with Victoria. And I do, just like I was referring to earlier, free yoga for teachers, but also workshops and different more long retreats and such if you're looking to reset for yourself. I'm on LinkedIn, Victoria Veneziano, Meteor Education. Not too many people with my name. It is a big mouthful, but if you go over to Language of Behavior show notes, I'm sure my last name is spelled out there for you.
Yes.
So very much looking forward to connecting. Thank you for
awesome.
That.
Yeah, I will, of course, as usual, have everything in the show notes for folks to make it super simple and easy for you. So make sure that you are clicking on the various links that you see and make sure that you are connecting with Victoria because, like I said at the beginning of the show, she's amazing. She's doing awesome work. And again, we are so thankful for your time today as we are learning not only about what you do, but also all the fantastic things that our teachers who are listening can implement right away. So with that, thank you so much again, Victoria, for being here with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. We'll see you on the next episode.